Please note that this podcast is intended to give advice to ostomates. The information given is based on personal experiences and should not be taken as clinical advice. Please consult with your stoma care nurse if you are in need of medical advice. Welcome to season 2, episode 2 of the Let's Talk podcast. This podcast is sponsored by Pelican Healthcare, who are a manufacturer of stoma care products, including the Modafii. If you do wish to sample any products, please do head over to www.pelicanhealthcare.co.uk. All links to this will be provided in the bio on the podcast. So tonight we are going to be talking about IBD and manifestations and things that you may not necessarily hear about. And with it being World IBD Day, I am joined by Louise, who goes under Young Crohn's on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. And I'm also joined by Liam, who goes under IBD Liam. And obviously my handle is at Crohn's Fighting and I'm Louise. So tonight I'm joined by both Louise and Liam, and this is purely dedicated for World IBD Day. And obviously we all have Crohn's disease. I felt it was quite fitting because you see, obviously, pictures of us, or you read our blog posts about getting through life after surgery or how to manage your stoma, but you don't always necessarily hear about us talking about life with Crohn's disease or life with IBD, just purely because not everybody wants to listen to it. We have had instances in the past within the community where if you do list all your ailments, you can get accused of being competitive, or my illness is better than yours, or having a one-upmanship over somebody else. But I think it is really important that we talk about all these issues tonight, just purely because Crohn's disease doesn't go away after surgery. I mean, I'm surgery 30 odd in, not including day surgeries for colonoscopies, CT scans, MRIs, not to mention other bits and pieces. So I've known Louise for a while. I've actually known Louise since I started blogging. So it's coming up for about 6 years now, I think. So I will let Louise introduce herself. I will hand over.
Hi. So, little introduction to me. I'm Louise, as Louise said, which is going to be very strange in this podcast today. I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease 11 years ago now. And it was a rough ride, let's be honest. Diagnosis is not easy. But I ended up having my really big IBD surgery 6.5 years ago, with subsequent surgeries quite soon after to create my stoma. And about 3 years ago, making my stoma permanent, which was a journey in itself with wounds and healing and all that delightful stuff. It's been one of those journeys where I've decided to share my own journey online, in social media, on my blog, you know, trying to do the best that I can to shed light on the reality of what it is like to live with a chronic illness and a chronic digestive condition. Basically that is what I do. I do my advocacy online. It does feel like a full-time job at the same time, but I absolutely love it. Love sharing my life with you guys online.
And what about you, Liam? How did you start with everything with Crohn's?
I've had Crohn's for about 6 or 7 years now, severe Crohn's disease. Only nearly a year today, I've had my ileostomy bag. So I've had that for a year, but all over them 6 or 7 years or so, it's just been constant battles, ups and downs of all the things I've had to fight off. Not just the Crohn's side, but all the side effects that come along with it. 4 operations on abscesses, pretty much. They were all during lockdown as well. That's mine summed up.
Do you know what? I think I'm really jaded. Obviously, I'm 20 years in this year with Crohn's disease. Obviously, I was diagnosed quite young, so I'm 36 now. I was diagnosed, I think it was between my 17th and 18th birthday.
I think I was about 15.
Oh, bless you. And I think at the time, I just wasn't taken seriously. I had everything. I had the extreme weight loss, the extreme constipation, to the extreme diarrhea, not wanting to eat because I knew if I eat, it was going to cause pain. I've had cellulitis on the legs. The only reason I got diagnosed was because I developed an intercutaneous fistula. I was actually quite lucky. I don't know whether it's pot luck or whether my body just thought it was being funny at the time, but it come up through my belly button. And I lived with that fistula for a very long time. I think I was 24 when the fistula was finally removed, but that was only because my bowel got perforated during my C-section. I've tried every drug known to man. There are a lot of drugs, and I don't know if this is quite prominent with Crohn's disease patients, but there are a lot of drugs that I'm either immune or resistant to, or I build up severe antibodies. So even though it's working, I've got antibodies, it's dangerous. So I then have to come off of that, and then they have to find something else to treat me with. And I don't think I've ever actually achieved true remission from Crohn's disease. It's always ticking away there. And obviously being an as old a veteran as what I am, obviously there's other things associated with Crohn's disease, which is microscopic Crohn's disease. So when it goes from the inside of the bowel to the outside of the bowel, and then starts, the scar tissue that's coming off of that starts attaching itself to other organs in your body. Hi. Not to mention other bits and pieces. And I think the thing is, I think a lot of people, or our family or friends or those that don't really know us, automatically assume that if we're having stoma surgery, and that once we've had that stoma surgery, that we're going to be better. And that's not always the case, because unfortunately for us with Crohn's, you can do a surgery, you can take away the part that's affected, and then it'll sit there for 6 months to a year to 2 years, then it go, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to jump ship to that other bit of bowel that, you know, was healthy. Well, it's not anymore. And I mean, how do you deal with that? Because I think it has such a massive impact both on us physically and mentally.
Yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, about what surgery actually means for someone who's got Crohn's disease. You know, they see a stoma as either one, really disgusting and something you really shouldn't be talking about or want to have, or it's something that's going to really make you feel a lot better. And, you know, you can feel quite, you know, really, really well with a stoma, but with Crohn's disease, it never goes away. So you live in a constant fear of, when is it going to come back and bite me in the butt? And to try and explain that to people over and over again, even people who are really close to you, is... it's really challenging to start with, but then after a while it gets really boring, because no one wants to.
Like, they get sick of hearing it.
Yeah, people get sick of hearing that you're sick, because they think you've cured it. And I'm like, no, it's not cured it. It has just made my quality of life much better than the 20 times a day that I was going to the toilet or being unable to eat. It's improved that, which hasn't cured me. So there are some very tricky conversations that, you know, I've had to have, and they play on my mind, because that's the kind of person I am. I think about things a real great deal. So yeah, it gives me a lot of anxiety, you know, it's given me a bit of depression, and I didn't really connect that until I had surgery, that I was depressed the entire time that I've had IBD, that I think about things really negatively, even though there's a lot of positivity in my life. I'm always thinking about when is my disease going to come and ruin my life. And it's a really tricky thing to get used to. I mean, I'm still struggling with it. Yeah, that's where I'm at.
So your weight on your shoulder that you're carrying around, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like the weight of the world. Because
yeah, because
obviously I had my surgery after with having Maisie, and I had temporary stoma, open wound, everything else. And then I had my reversal surgery, and it was just automatically assumed at work at the time, oh, because you've had your reversal surgery, that's it, you're absolutely fine, you're not ill anymore. I'm like, no, that's not the case. And then obviously, like, having to sit down with my mum and that and explain, like, obviously in 2016 again, that I needed to have the surgery. And my mum knew deep down that I had to have the surgery, but she's like, well, what if you don't make it off of the operating table again? And I'm like, yeah, but I have a really bad habit of going bye-byes under anaesthetic. So anybody's listening and thinking, how the hell is she laughing? Honest to God, it's the only way that I can deal with things. I just have a really dark, dire, gallows humour. If I don't laugh about it, I think I've cried that much over the years. I can't cry anymore. It's just laughing is just an automatic response. And you know, it's difficult having to have those conversations with your loved ones that I've got to have this surgery. Oh, why couldn't you have that done at the time? I wouldn't have made it through. That's why I had my surgery done in two parts and 2 years apart. And things went really bad after my last surgery. I disappeared off of the intensive care unit for hours because they couldn't get my pain under control. I'd gone septic again. My lactate levels were through the roof, some other bits and pieces. I think it was my lactate levels. It was something to do with lactate levels or something. So, and it's just, I'm like, how much more can I put people through? And then I've been having issues and I've got ulceration on my stoma, which is through my Crohn's, and it's been happening like the last 18 months. And my surgeon's like, well, why don't we give it another 6 months for the med? Why don't we give it another 6 months? Just because if I have another surgery, my stoma is going to end up in duodenostomy territory, and I don't know if I can handle that.
No. Yeah, it's weighing up all those things, isn't it? You know, one surgery could potentially lead to another, or one surgery could lead to a complication, or lead to something else you've got to deal with afterwards that you hadn't really considered. But like you, I have a very dark sense of humor with it. I do laugh.
I'm the same.
Yeah. I remember laughing when they told me that I'd got C. diff again, and I'd only been diagnosed 3 or 4 weeks, and I was like, are you absolutely kidding me? And I just sat there laughing, and they were like, what's wrong with you? I was like, because I can't cry anymore. And literally, like, you're just telling me the like worst case scenario. And it's just getting worse. So how else do you respond to something like that?
I remember being in the doctor's with my mom, and he mentioned I was going to get something, and we both just started laughing. And he's looking at us like, you know, it's quite serious. That it's like, oh, yeah, I know. It's like just another thing to add to the list. Like, but me and my mom both know, like, obviously how everything is and how I normally deal with it. But like I say, we just sat there laughing about it.
Yeah, but you have to laugh, or else, or it just doesn't bear thinking about crying again, does it? Because once you do start crying, it doesn't matter whether you're male or female. IBD can break down the strongest person, anybody with a really strong mental will. If you've been putting up with IBD and Crohn's as long as what we've had and what we've put up with, it's enough to break down the strongest of person. It's just, I think it gets soul destroying. And I think when obviously IBD day happens, we don't really see obviously the soul destroying part of the journey. You obviously see the diagnosis, you see the bit of the bad time and then the better and how things are under control. But, you know, kind of that's not always the case. It's always ticking away from manifestations as well, because this is not spoken about enough. It's always just assumed that, oh, IBD, you poo a lot, you can't eat, you lose weight, that's it. They give you steroids, they give you medication, kind of problem sorted. But it's not the case at all, is it? Don't get me wrong, there are some great medications now, and if I was diagnosed now instead of when I was diagnosed back in 2002, it would probably be a totally different story, my journey and how I can talk about it now. But there just wasn't the medication back then that there is now. I mean, they actually now have specific immunosuppressants for Crohn's patients. They have specific immunosuppressants for ulcerative colitis patients, and they're not just treating us like we have Hodgkin's lymphoma. Louise is laughing because she knows exactly what I'm talking about. Obviously, so a little bit of background. Immunosuppressants that they use to treat us are normally primarily used as chemotherapy for cancer patients. I think the correct terminology for how they treat IBD as a general whole is like a cancer. So the answer is to knock out our immune system, to stop our immune system from fighting itself. Basically, we have an overactive immune system, and even though it's healthy, it considers the organs in our body, i.e. the bowels and other bits and pieces, as a danger, so the body tries to kill it. Would that be correct summary, Louise?
Yeah. Attack of the Crohn's, that's what it is.
Attack of the Crohn's?
Yeah.
It's the attack of something. Yeah. I mean,
every day it's something new that's getting attacked.
I mean, Liam, you was talking to us earlier, and what was you talking to us about with something to do with sinuses?
Abscesses.
Sinus tracts. That was me. Yeah.
But you've both had those, haven't you, in your bottom where you've had to have them. Could either of you explain or see what they are?
I'll let you explain. You probably know it a little bit. I'm not great with details.
So there's something called sinus tracts within the body. They're all over. In particular, my body decides to attack my sinus tracts in my butt cheeks. So I've had 4 surgeries over the last year to open them up, drain them, and heal them. By the fact that I've had 4, it's been on the same one because they've decided not to heal. They appear like boils or abscesses. The way in which my surgeon described them is just another delightful manifestation of Crohn's disease. That's not very common. And I was like, well, that suits me because I seem to be accumulating all the special parts of Crohn's disease. And they can be quite tricky to manage. And the only kind of intervention is a biological medication that will control the gut inflammation. So having the IBD under control and then surgically excising them seems to work quite well, but they do reoccur, and I've got one reoccurring at the minute, so I'm a bit grumpy today. But yeah, so that's just another thing that I've had to deal with, and we don't know where it's come from, why it's decided to happen now. And I think with Crohn's disease in particular, you tend to just deal with what's in front of you, because something will come up. I've learned the hard way over the last 11 years that something is always going to come up and scare the pooper out of me, or, you know, bite me on the butt. So I'm prepared in a nice way, like a mental kind of way, that something is going to go wrong.
It's like we've been through that much, we just know something's going to happen.
Yeah. I'm very pessimistic today. This is terrible. But I think this is the reality, you know. I can't always be a sunshiny person. And, you know, today I really hate my body. It's peeing me off. But you know what? Tomorrow I will deal with it. And that is how we deal with it, isn't it? I'm sure you guys would agree.
It's like every time I get something back on track,
yes,
it's like something else crops up. So I do a lot. I'm quite an active person. So obviously I work, I do the ambassador things, I do the advocacy thing, which takes up quite a fair amount of my free time. Okay, I work part-time, I work 3 days a week, but obviously that is pretty full-on. I've also then gone back into like full adult education. I'm doing an advanced diploma in like AAT at the moment, which is the equivalent of a university degree, so I can become a chartered accountant. And it's just like when I think that I've got everything on track and that everything's going okay, I get tired, I can't sleep, I really want to sleep, but I can't sleep. And obviously, because of the medication that I'm on, my GP won't give me sleeping tablets because I'm on nerve blockers and obviously I'm on codeine. So my GP's like, well, I'm not going to give you sleeping tablets. And I'm like, but I can't sleep. And she's like, well, why can't you sleep? And I said, because I can't. I said, this just, everything's keeping me awake at night.
If we knew why we couldn't sleep, it'd be so much easier.
It's a million-dollar question, isn't it?
It's the pain, though, isn't it? I think in the day, when we're busy...
Mm.
And when we're active, we can manage the pain and you can kind of sideline it. But when you're laying in bed of a night time and you go to sleep and then you get woken up by sharp, stabby gremlin pains at 3 a.m, it's what I call them, gremlins, in the abdomen, the pain takes your breath away and you can't get back to sleep because of it. And if you have 2 or 3 bad nights, because it can either go on for 2 or 3 days or it gets to the point of it goes on longer than that, but you kind of just get used to it so you can kind of sleep through it, it just has just an entire negative effect on your mental health. Because I think with pain, with obviously Crohn's disease, I think when we can sleep and we've actually got the energy reserves, we can manage the pain better. But I think when we're not sleeping, and we don't have those energy reserves, you just, your body cannot cope with what is being put through.
I don't know. Would you get into that cycle as well. If you've had a really bad sleep, you think, oh, I'll just sleep more the next night, and you can't. Or you say, I'm just going to cut down on X, Y, or Z. But that's not a long-term solution, is it? Like, I can't stop studying because I'm doing the same degree as you. It needs doing, but I need my sleep. There's not a lot of leeway when it comes to pain like that, especially when you're trying to sleep. And for me, it's getting comfortable. That's the main problem. Like, it'll take me an hour and a half to get comfortable, and then I'll have really disruptive sleep. So I tend to just mainline coffee the next day, and that doesn't really solve the problem, does it? Really, it's underlying pain.
I'm similar, but with energy drinks.
Yeah.
That's no, fine. You shouldn't be drinking those. Sorry.
I'm not too bad.
I'm probably sounding like a mum here. But
you are a mum.
It's all good.
I know, but...
energy drinks. Dear.
Yeah, Crohn's disease and energy drinks and sugar is a big no-no.
I know.
And it
like
might...
Like I say, it's not too bad now.
...exacerbating some of your symptoms.
like I say, it's not too bad, but that's what I was relying on when my sleep was... poor. And then I'm having it, like you said, like I've got uni or work or something to go and do.
And I think we've got this part of us, because we've been so sick, we want to do all the things that normal people do. So we don't want to give up our work, or we don't want to give up our studying. You don't want to give up your social life.
I feel like we've probably all done it. We'll all try push ourselves to do what normal people do, and then
that's
another knock-on effect to whatever symptom comes our way then.
Yeah. And that's the thing I get commented most about is, why don't you just cut out this? I'm like,
oh, have you tried this diet or
I'm not
going
to stop it. You know, it's that's not a helpful comment to me. And, you know, it comes from people close to me as well. It's, you'd be better if you just went to bed earlier.
I just laugh at stuff like that now, but like inside, it's like, just please just leave us alone.
Yeah. I know they mean well. And I know that it comes from a good place, but it's not helpful. And if I'm not in the particularly right atmosphere or the right frame of mind, I will snap. And I don't like snapping. But yeah, after a couple of days, you just need to sleep, don't you? Yeah, there you go.
I know exactly what you mean. And the thing is, I'm very lucky. I have a very supportive husband. Ben's always trying to pack me off to bed, or, oh, why don't you work from home today? Because obviously you've not had a good night's sleep and everything else. But it is just so hard. I think it's not that, it's the other things that come with it. It's like, so my youngest brother, my little brother, Harrison, he is 30. Make sure I get this right. He's 32 this year. He's been having ongoing symptoms for bloody years, won't listen to me. It's finally got to the point in the last year of, oh my God, this is absolutely horrendous. I need to get this dealt with. And I think, especially for those of you listening that suspect that you have IBD, but you still haven't done anything about it, you really do need to learn to advocate for yourself. And if you cannot advocate for yourself, then I know COVID remit is kind of means that you can't take somebody with you, but it's you need to, if you can't advocate for yourself, you need to get somebody else to advocate for you. You know, the last sort of 4 or 5 months, I've been up A&E several times with my brother to try and get sorted. I've been on the phone to the GP. He's given me permission. He's given, obviously, permission for me to talk to the GP and to explain everything that's going on and my history and everything else. He had the tests. They got the tests. They sat on them for 4 months. So I get a phone call yesterday from my brother going, he's going, oh, you know that fecal cow, what's it thing? I said, oh, you mean the fecal cow protector? And he's going, yeah, that's the one. He's going, it's come back borderline. And I said, well, he said, if it's come back borderline, I said, then you're going to have to go for a colonoscopy. I said, and you're going to have bloods. And he's going, but why do I have to have a colonoscopy? I said, because if you've had Crohn's disease for a long time, I said, and you've just got used to dealing with it, I said, your bloods aren't going to come back like a newly diagnosed person. I said, your body gets used to fighting it. I said, so your CRP, your body doesn't fight the way it used to. It's just something that's kind of just ticking along in the background. I said, so you need to go and have a colonoscopy. And he's going, but I don't want to have one of them done. I'm going, but you've got to. And he's going, I'm going to be awake. I went, no, take the drugs.
Oh, dear, bless him.
You know, he's having the, you know, he's having this heart to heart with me yesterday on the phone, and he's like, he's going, if I end up with a stoma, he's going, I don't mind, he's going, but it's the pain, he's going, I can't deal with the pain, and he's going, I don't understand, he said, how you've got to where you are, he said, and you don't moan. And I said, what do you mean I don't moan? And he's going, well, you don't moan. He said, but he said, I know when you're tired. He said, and I know when you're in pain. He said, I can see it on your face. He said, I can see it in your eyes. He said, but you just don't say anything. I said, well, you don't, babe. So you just learn to live with it. And, you know, he's like, well, what if I can't handle it? What if I'm not man enough? And I'm like,
oh.
But there must be a lot of people that feel like that. And I don't think anybody gets the mental health help that they need.
Yeah.
I feel like I've had bad times, like mentally. I'll go and try say something, and then they seem to brush you off way too easy. And then you come back home and you're sat there like, what's like? Do I try again? Do I just wait? Just, I've been in a massive loop for that at certain times before.
Yeah,
I just think the thing is we with everything that's going on, and obviously I've got diagnosed medical PTSD, obviously from like life support and comas and God knows whatever else, several bouts of sepsis, fecal peritonitis, just to mention a few. I've had mental health help, and obviously I've been offered drugs before to help with the PTSD, and I'm like, but I'm not taking any more medication than I have to. I'm on enough as it is on a day-to-day basis. I don't want to take something else that's going to totally zone me out. So, you know, I've had counselling. I have CBT help, CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy help. And obviously if my mental health starts declining or my anxiety starts getting really bad, I go back on a CBT course to help, just to kind of re-establish the coping mechanisms. I mean, how do you use to find, obviously, like, the mental health battle? Because it's not just physical, is it? It's mental as well.
I think when I was first diagnosed, it was harder because I couldn't really do much. So I'd just be sat at home, like, in pain and sick. I'd be seeing people do what they want to do, and then I'd get like down and upset, and then obviously I couldn't do that. I'd just sit at home just thinking things. Then, like I said, I'd ask like someone for help, and it just seemed like it was never getting anywhere.
Yeah. I remember having CBT at the very beginning when I got diagnosed. And it was more about learning how I was going to cope with it, because it was a lot, you know, long-term condition. And I had a counsellor who was specialised in that. So that was really lucky. And I had that for about 3 or 4 months. But I wasn't taking any medication at that point for anything like anxiety or depression. It was after my stoma that I started the medication for anxiety and depression. And I still take it. And I've had CBT, you know, a couple times since, and it's always been very different. And it still gives me the heebie-jeebies because I feel like I should be able to cope with this on my own.
But you can't cope with it on your own. This is, I think this is why we do advocacy stuff. It's why we do the ambassador stuff, because, you know, I'll be perfectly honest, when I first started, I didn't intend to end up where I am now. I was just using it. I was just using it as a thought space, as a get support from somebody else to give me a kind of bit of validation, whether or not I was having a good day or a bad day. And, you know, somebody else that I could find relatable, or somebody else that could find me relatable. Because the thing is, IBD is quite an isolating illness.
Yeah.
Because it's you that's going through it, because you can't see what's going on inside. On the outside, I think there are a lot of times where people might get fed up, or people aren't as sympathetic as they may be, because they can't see what's going on.
Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes we feel that way as well, that because we can't see what's going on, I must be fine. I know I've had those moments where I'm like, yeah, it's fine, there's nothing wrong with me, but then the pain kicks in, or the blockage happens, or the bowel twists, and I'm like, yep, there's definitely something wrong.
Oh yeah, let's talk about strictures.
Oh,
all three of us got them.
Yep. Joys have joys.
I mean, what about you, Liam? Wait, because you were saying about your strictures.
Strictures.
Bowel narrowings. So when you've got scar tissue in the bowel.
Oh, I don't really know much about mine, to be honest.
You have one.
I'm not really sure about that.
So for those of you listening, obviously this is more prominent in Crohn's disease patients than ulcerative colitis patients, but the nature of Crohn's disease can cause the bowel to disintegrate, and it can also cause scar tissue to build up either on the inside or the outside of the bowel. When you do get strictures or you do get scar tissue in the bowel, that can lead to fistulating Crohn's disease. So that can lead to fistulas forming. So basically the bowel breaks down, you develop an abscess, that abscess causes a tunnel. The tunnel then finds some various novelty places to come out. So mine was the belly button, but for some it might be rectal vaginal, or it could be a rectal fistula, it could be an anal fistula, it could be there's so many other places that they can come out. I mean, they can come out on your thigh, they can come out in your abdomen. There are times when, obviously not to scare people listening to this, and apologies to those, but obviously don't get scared, but obviously they can tunnel back and go through the kidneys and come out through the back. There's a lot of people that I've known with Crohn's disease, especially that I follow on Instagram. So things like Robbie and Daddy, he had so many fistulas in and around his stomacite. It was absolutely crazy. And that's because of his Crohn's. And the thing is with fistulas, because of the nature of Crohn's disease, and because when you are in flare, it is actually quite dangerous to do surgery on people, because the bowel can disintegrate. And obviously that can lead to sepsis. A lot of them will do a seton surgery. So they will open the fistula up, they'll put a seton in the hopes that that will help the fistula heal from the inside out. But
can I add something on? Sorry, I'll apologise. No one's actually ever used the word strictures with me before, but I've actually got a seton band insert at the minute, which I've had for 2 or 3 years, maybe.
And where's that?
How do I explain this? This is just pretty much right underneath where my genitals are.
Okay.
So a little story which we were about before. I was in hospital getting one of my abscesses operated on. Some like young nurse came in. She must have been a student, and she came in to pack where the hole was, which is where you put in a bit of ribbon to kind of keep it clean. And she came in, and I'm just sat there with my legs spread on the bed, and she's asking where it is. And I kind of lift up the bits where it is, and we're both just laughing because neither of us knew really what to do or what to say. But luckily, we're seeing the funny side.
But that is really common in men. the fistulas for men, it's quite typical because I'm guessing it was just under your testicles.
Pretty much close to there, yeah.
Which, because obviously, because that's quite close to obviously your back passage, and obviously the gaps that you've got obviously from where your bowel is and where that's tunneled down, that is quite common for it to happen to men. But fistulating Crohn's disease, because that's the other thing as well, the Crohn's disease diagnosis, I can never quite get my head round, because there's so many forms of Crohn's disease, and this is when arguments start online, when people say that they've got Crohn's and they've also got microscopic colitis. Unfortunately, the term microscopic colitis is used for Crohn's disease patients, but what that actually means is that the Crohn's has gone from inside the bowel to outside the bowel. And obviously Crohn's disease, it affects the entirety of the digestive tract. But there are a lot of people that might turn around and say, oh, I've got Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And then there's people going, well, you can't have both. You've either got one or the other. And it's just because sometimes obviously your IBD consultant might not actually explain the differentiation between ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, and obviously the difference between microscopic colitis and microscopic Crohn's, as some of them call it, is actually trying to explain that obviously it's actually gone through the entirety of the bowel tissue and entirety through the entirety of the inside of the intestine to the outside. And it started attaching itself to other bits and pieces. Louise has given me a thumbs up. I should do some medical research.
Yeah, it's the terminology, isn't it? It's like when they say Crohn's colitis, and you're like, well, that's Crohn's disease that goes through all layers of the bowel, but is located in just the colon.
Yeah.
And then you get small bowel Crohn's, and then you get stricturing Crohn's or narrowing Crohn's disease, fistulating Crohn's disease,
Crohn's disease.
It just goes on and on and on, doesn't it? But I think most of those things are only seen when there's additional diagnostic tools like an MRI scan or CT if you're at a pinch. But yeah, that's how I got my stricturing disease diagnosed, was with a CT scan, because they could see it, and they sent me for an MRI scan to make sure that what they were seeing was correct. But yeah, I had a really big narrowing before I had a right hemicolectomy done, because my medication wasn't doing anything. Medication isn't going to solve a narrowing. Surgical intervention is the only thing. And I didn't go back on any medication, and my entire colon decided to just disintegrate. The words they used was, looks like hamburger meat. And that's really sexy.
Dead professional of them.
And I was like, no, it's not. But yeah, it was, because I saw the camera. And that's when I started pooping blood. And I was like, stoma surgery, please.
I mean, Louise, do you not have a port in at the moment?
I do, yes.
And can you explain to everybody why you had that port in and why it's used?
Why it's used. So over the last 11 years, I've had the majority of my treatment has been biologic medication. And apart from about a year when I was on Humira injections, I've been on infliximab and vedolizumab.
Infliximab worked amazing for me for a while.
It did. Oh, and then I had really, really, really high, like off the charts of the actual test, antibodies for it.
That was me eventually.
Yep. I was having the medication every 6 weeks with methotrexate and folic acid until NICE approved vedolizumab. And I was the first patient on it in my hospital. And I was like, excellent. But because they've obviously all been infusions and cannulas, my veins are absolutely shot. So when I was switched over to subcutaneous vedolizumab injections, I thought, great, no more cannulas. But I started to have a reaction, as you do. So I switched back to infusions at the beginning of the year, had a PICC line, but was allergic to the PICC line dressings. So we had a port put in March, and that's been working really well since. I will admit it wasn't the greatest day surgery I ever had done, because it scared the bejesus out of me. The amount of tugging on my neck, and I can still feel it at some time. So yeah, it does work really well. And I'm learning how to flush it myself, but I'm only using it for infusions at the minute. So it's definitely made my current IBD a lot easier to deal with. Like, there's no fear of a six attempts at getting a cannula, having to be ultrasound scanned. Or
I used to tell them I'd come back the next day after six or seven attempts, like, because I just felt sick at it.
Yeah. And the thing is, obviously, with Bedo, once they've mixed it up, it's got to be used. So they'd have to go and get other doctors to come and cannulise me. And I was just like, this is getting ridiculous. So the only way I would say to them that I was going to go back on infusions was to have a central line put in. And yeah, it is scary, because obviously it's central line, you think infection risk, but it's really well looked after. And I really like the port. Not that I think you should ever, you know, people should get one, but, you know, it's
really, no, but really I know exactly what you're talking about, because my veins are knackered. I mean, when I turn up in the summer, if I catch the sun, I look like a human pincushion. A lot of veins in my hands and my arms have collapsed. I think there's only one vein left on my left arm that they can actually still get into,
yeah,
to either take blood or to put fluids into me, which is why I end up with central lines whenever I have surgery, because they can't get an IV into me anywhere else. So I do sit there sometimes, I think, it's probably a good idea. But then I've also had Hickman lines in, and obviously when you've got a Hickman in line in and you've had it in for a long period of time, so obviously I think I had mine in for 9 months, it's actually quite dangerous. And I only realized that they kept me in hospital as long as what they did when I had the Hickman line in wasn't maybe because I wasn't ready to go home. It was because I had a Hickman line in, and I had to learn how to look after that Hickman line and how to shower and how to wash and how to avoid catching it or pulling it out, because it goes through the main artery in your heart.
Yeah, because imagine that being pulled, like, that's going to spurt some blood, that is. Oh no.
I was just going to say, that's making me shiver talking about that.
Sorry, yeah. Sorry to everyone listening, we're talking about.
It is a reality, though. I mean, when I go for an MRI and they can't get a cannula into me, and they're going, oh, should we start having a look at your feet? I'm like, no, you can.
That's the worst sentence I ever hear when they're struggling.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember coming out of my last surgery, or waking up from my last surgery. I had one cannula in my hand when I went under. When I came out, I had three failed attempts on the other arm and a cannula in my foot. And they used the cannula in my foot to give me fluids, because the one on my hand blew. And I was like, excellent, great. But it is what it is. Like, they need to get access. They've got to go for it. And I've had many times where I've been in hospital for 2 or 3 weeks and I've had 8, 9 cannulas. And it's because they're overused. So I'm very grateful that I've got my port in now. I do not look forward to the day when I have to go in for an admission, because obviously I know it will be used. But I know that that's going to make me feel less anxious about potentially having to go in, because getting cannulated is the one thing that gives me a lot of anxiety when I first go in, because they have to be really good at getting a cannula. Otherwise, I'm going to get really frustrated. And the last thing you want to do is piss me off when you're trying to get a cannula when I've come into A&E as an emergency. Like, I'm already going to be really annoyed. So yeah, I love it, but it's a really big deal.
I feel your pain, because last time I was in hospital, I documented quite a bit of it, because obviously I had an intra-abdominal abscess, which is obviously another manifestation of Crohn's disease. It's something that I've suffered with. It's always on my stomach. Sometimes it's a lot closer to my vagina. So it's kind of like in my pubis area. So it's just above my vagina, but it's below my hip. I've had so many abscesses there. It's unreal. I also have a lot on my right hand side. I'm not too sure, obviously, whether that or not, because that might be because of the scar tissue from where I had my original stoma.
Is your stoma on the left side at the minute, then?
Yeah, my stoma's on the left, because there's not enough bowel to push it over to the right. Because obviously the rest of my small bowels are geared by scar tissue because of the Crohn's and because of the surgery. Mm-hmm. They can't unpick it, because if they try and unpick it from the scar tissue, that bowel could disintegrate, and obviously I could then like end up with duodenostomy. So they decided not to play and tinker too much with that. We'll just leave that the way it is. But last time I was in hospital with the abscess, my cannulas were blowing on a daily basis. If they're blowing on a daily basis, then that means my veins are absolutely knacked. And I've got another nurse, because I'm on IV antibiotics, we've got to try and get another cannula in you. And I'm like, but I'm telling you, it's absolutely knacked. What else can you do? Well, there's nothing we can do at the moment. And I'm just like, so you've got to sit there and get some inept idiot twatting me about with a needle for the seventh or eighth time, just because you've got to give me IV antibiotics and because you knew it was going to blow, and I told you it was going to blow and you wouldn't listen to me, and it blew anyway, so here we go.
Happens a lot that you'll speak to them saying something and like they'll never take your point of view.
No, unless you get the same doctor twice. How rare is that?
Look, for me, I used to get it quite a lot when I was living back home, because it was quite a small place, but now I'm in like a bigger city, it's just like you just said there.
Yeah, it's when they blow at 3 a.m. and you've got to have the on-call registrar come and do it.
I made my dietitian cry, and the IBD consultant that was on call let come and discharged me finally after being discharged, and he said you might be an annoying patient for people, he said, but you are the best patient, he said, because you know your body. He said, you know exactly what's going on. He said, you won't take any crap.
That's a bit like me, I reckon.
He said, and your arguments with the dietitian were justified at the time.
I love how arguments were done. It's great. Not great fun, but you know, when you just need to stand your ground, and that can be really challenging at times. But when you do it, it's just like, don't mess with me. I know my own anatomy. And I think that's a really big key thing with advocacy, is that we know our bodies so well. And it's really hard for doctors who, you know, have spent many, many years becoming consultants or just doctors in general. And they're like, no, this is what I know. And I'm like, no, I have lived in experience. Please listen to me. I know when a cannula is going to blow. I know when it's not even in the right place before you've even tried. You just knackle up my skin. That's fine.
It is so important to advocate for yourself, though. I mean, you can advocate for yourself with your doctors, with your surgeons. You don't have to be abusive. You don't have to raise your voice. You just have to know what you're talking about. Yeah. And that is why it is so important to learn about your illness and to learn about your body and to check your medical records.
Yeah.
Because the thing is, I think there's a lot of people that slip through the net because they don't know how to advocate for themselves. They don't necessarily know how to argue, but argue on a level that the doctors will actually understand why you're having that rather, you know, heated debate with them, shall we say. I mean, that I'll be perfectly honest with you, there is never any rhyme or reason for you to swear or be abusive or to be nasty to your medical team. That's not on. At the end of the day, they're doing their job and they're trying to look after you. But you can be articulate, you can know yourself, and you can know what will and what will not work. And that is the difference about being able to advocate for yourself and knowing your illness, rather than just doing something that you know it isn't going to work, but you do it because you're being told to do it.
I felt like this was how I got my stone run away, because they were suggesting like a couple of meds, and I thought, like I said to them, like, look, I'm not willing to do that. Told them why and everything, and they were happy, like listening to it and go, right, we'll speak to other people and we'll talk about getting your operation done.
Yeah, because it's what you think is best. It's your patient choice at the end of the day. And no one should be telling you that you need to take this medication or that's it. There's always another workaround.
I wanted my operation earlier than I did, to be fair, because I was flying through the meds I was given. I thought, like, if I'm going through all these how I am, like, what's the chances in another med working?
Yeah,
it is so common, though.
I think it's having those kinds of thoughts of yeah, it could be quite negative thinking, what if this doesn't work? But I think that is a good reality to have, is yes, we may have plan A, but what about plan B, C and D? You know, that's how I went into having vedolizumab the first time, is what are my other options? So if this doesn't work, because, you know, 40% chance it's not going to, what else have we got? And my surgeon, my consultant at the time, listed off a load of meds. They had really dangerous and high risk side effects. And I mentioned to him, what about surgery?
And I was the first one to mention surgery as well.
Yeah. And he was just shocked. He was shook that I was asking such a, to him, probably a very brazen, you know, brazen question at that point. You know, I was, how old was I when I had my first surgery? 28. So, you know, I was late 20s. I didn't want to spend any more time pooping all the time, unnecessarily, you know, having chronic B&D. It was a nightmare. The pain that I was in, I was just like, I wanted someone to just end it.
It's like, you're in that bad state, like, what's the worst that can happen? Like, I'll just go for the surgery.
Yeah. And like, I had a really good conversation with the surgeon who did my first surgery. And he really understood where I was coming from, because they don't want to do surgery unnecessarily. They want to do surgery in a controlled way. They don't want to do emergency surgery because you have better control, you have better outcomes. So he planned my first surgery. And yeah, I didn't respond very well to it, and I flared and lost my colon. But I think those 3 months that I spent struggling really built my advocacy, because I was annoying as hell. I was asking questions, I was disagreeing. I was like, why do I need to take this? And, you know, really getting to know things. And I constantly said, I'm in pain, it is here, and told them. And it was me constantly doing that that then led them to doing a scope to find out that it was completely knackered. And when I came out of that surgery, my IBD nurse and my surgeon and consultant came over and said, we should have listened to you. You were right.
The only way mine listened to me, it was like the end of, 2021 or 2020 or something. And I rang my IBD like specialist, and I just broke down on the phone, like, upset. I said, like, look, I want this operation. And he just turned around and go, like, all right, we'll think it's the right time now.
Yeah.
So it took that phone call just for him to realise, like, oh, he needs to be done.
It, do you know what it does me? Because I remember when I first started blogging, and obviously I explained why I had the surgery, I had a troll at the time say to me, you're not ill. You've just gone and had this operation. So, like, you can be something. And I was like, do you have any idea? You know, the NHS aren't just going to go and stick you on an operating theatre table and go, here you go, here's a stoma surgery, and here's a stoma because I want to make a spectacle of myself. It's like, do you not realise, like, the planning that goes into stoma surgery, especially with a Crohn's patient, and especially with a Crohn's patient that's got as extensive history as I have, that has, my pelvic area is literally concrete scar tissue. Some of my organs, so, like, both my kidneys and my urethra, and everything going towards my bladder, is all encased in scar tissue. It's why I can't have a hysterectomy, because they can't give me my hysterectomy without possibly giving me a urostomy.
Oh, okay. So, yeah, that's a yes, definitely no.
Yeah. And then I've got some idiot saying to me, oh, you're doing it because you just want to make something of yourself. And I'm like, what's
that? That is laughable, that is.
It's like we were saying earlier, some of the things people say or do, you just got to laugh at them.
Yeah, because you just can't quite believe sometimes the audacity of people's comments, that they think that it's an okay thing to say, that, oh, you look fat with that stoma bag, or you're just doing this for attention, or none of what you're saying is fake. It's all fake. It's, you know, and I'm just like, why would I lie about this? Of all the things I could choose to fib about, why would I lie about having multiple surgeries and going through a chronic illness? Like, there's nothing glamorous about this at all.
You see, the thing is when you put your hands up to do this podcast, Louise, I was like, yes, because she knows what she's talking about.
Oh,
and I know that, you know, but I know that sounds really thingy. But the thing is, there are a lot of people that have surgery and they don't necessarily know their body. They don't necessarily know about their illness, and they're just kind of advocating life after surgery. Whereas we tend to do a lot of in-depth stuff about Crohn's disease and about the impact of obviously the medications and other bits and pieces. And sometimes we don't always get the same recognition as other people do, because what we kind of, the picture that we paint isn't always a positive one. It's a bit of left and a bit of right, and occasionally a little bit in the middle with a bit of humour that's been plucked from some gallows over in Spain. it's the only way to put it. And it's, IBD is hard, and I love seeing people raise awareness on IBD Awareness Day. But it's kind of awareness of, oh, I was ill, I had my medication, I had my surgery, everything's now fine. And that's not always the case. And it's such a fine line, because anybody that's raising awareness is absolutely amazing and it's great. But you kind of have to have the realities of life. And that is the fact that the reality with IBD, you can't pick and choose as to when in it decides to flare or if it decides to go into remission. And I'll be perfectly honest with you, I don't think any of us with a logical mind would have picked this way of life that we're going through now, because, you know, our quality of life may be better and we are able to do things that we may not have necessarily been able to do without wearing a nappy or carrying spare knickers because you and your friend got drunk and you farted and it went the wrong way. I'm glad you're still laughing.
Yeah, been there.
I'm sure anyone who listens to it will laugh because it is reality.
Yeah.
But this is the reality of IBD. The reality is that it doesn't always go away, and that it does tend to come back and bite us on the bottom. And maybe talking about the manifestations that we suffer with rather than just living life after stoma surgery might be a bit more educational for people, and for people to be able to pinpoint and kind of go, oh, well, I think that's happening to me. I need to go and seek help. I need to go and get this checked. It's like the other thing, the mystical thing, the one thing that does me. I'm still currently waiting for a gynae referral because I'm currently going through the diagnosis of vaginal Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm. And I've had three registrars over the last couple of years tell me that it doesn't exist. For me then to finally get a face-to-face appointment with my IBD consultant and go, look, and he went, well, that's not right. I went, no, it's not right. I said, but look at what the last three have said. And he said, well, they said it's not a thing. I said, but it is a thing, isn't it? He's going, yes, it is a thing. And I'm like, it's like you're finally being listened to.
Yeah, you're finally getting that validation that it's not all in your head.
Yep.
Or in your case, your vagina.
Yep.
Sorry.
That's the thing, though. I literally have no shame no more. I have no.
Nor
shame.
Do I.
I have no dignity.
I wouldn't say I do.
No. I'm just like, let's crack on. Like, stuff needs doing. Just, yeah. Like, I'll go and see my surgeon tomorrow, and there'll be, he's a male, obviously a male surgeon. There will be a female chaperone. He won't have even pulled the curtain, and my pants will be down because I know he's going to have to look at my bum. And I'm just like, I'm going to have to do it. So, yeah. But I'm very honest with him. Like, I don't beat around the bush.
There's no point in beating around the bushes there.
No, quite interesting. And I've said to him on many occasions, like, he came very highly recommended when I first moved to Peterborough, where I currently live. I oddly said to, I think it must have been my mom or my dad, I said, the only person I will let operate on my ass is my surgeon. And my mom was just looking at me as if, like, how is that a normal thing to say? But it's normal to me because that's the level of trust I have. But that's what you build up, isn't it? Is when you have an honest and open conversation with a consultant, a nurse, a surgeon, you do get that really, I like to think it's quite nice, professional relationship where you can say what is bothering you because you're going for a medical reason, and they can offer you their opinion, because that's what I'm going for, to have a conversation.
Yeah,
I remember why my bum hurts.
I remember the last time I was in hospital, and obviously the surgery team were threatening to take me down to theatre and have a look inside. So I sent an email to my secretary, my surgeon secretary, and my surgeon was on the phone the next morning. He's like, "Don't you bloody touch her."
Yeah, I've had a surgeon and a consultant like that.
That's the thing, though. I think they see it's because we're complex case. It's like somebody's next paper. So they're all having like a little competition on who's got on how quick I'm going to go downhill and who's going to get in there first.
Because yeah. You've got to laugh, haven't you, really?
Yeah. Oh, that's dire. Really is dire.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's like, who wants to be a Crohn's disease? No one. Let's be honest. I don't want to be a complex case. I would love to have a really simple, mild form of Crohn's disease, but I just don't. And that's my burden to bear. And let's just get on with it and let's share it with the world, because there must be somebody else out there who either is going through what I've gone through or may go through it, or just wants to know that this is the reality of what it's like. Because we don't talk about it enough, do we? We talk about not necessarily the glamorous parts of IBD, but we talk about the really positive things. But yeah, there's always going to be a negative.
Yeah, I quite like talking about the negative sides of it all.
Yeah. And I'm not trying to be a gloomy Gus or a negative Nelly, but this is what it's like for me on some days. And if I neglect to share or even, you know, kind of comment on or in some way reflect on the negative parts, it kind of does injustice to the positive things, because there's always light and dark.
You know, don't get me wrong, if it wasn't for my surgery, I wouldn't be back in adult education. I wouldn't be doing my diploma that I stopped in my mid-20s. I wouldn't now be kind of like continuing that on if I hadn't have had the surgery and if I hadn't have been through the journey that I've been through.
Yeah.
You know, if it wasn't, if I didn't have Crohn's disease, if I wasn't diagnosed, I'd be a fully chartered accountant by now and I'd probably be earning my hundreds of thousands.
I think it's strange to think what would happen if we didn't have it.
Yeah. These are the thoughts that I don't like, because
I get what you mean.
Because like I've been doing AAT like you, Louise, and when I did level 2, I was in really good health, and then I went downhill really suddenly because I had a periostomal hernia, and I fell behind the class, and now everybody else has completed it, and I'm still stuck on level 3, and every couple of days, or you know, when I go back to studying, I get that little niggly feeling in, like, if I didn't have IBD, this could already be done. I do think about life without IBD, but then I think, I don't think I would be the same kind of person.
I don't know what I'd be doing now without it, because obviously you speak to loads of people with the illness and stuff like that. I think it'd be strange to live without it.
Yeah, I when I first got diagnosed, and I thought, oh, in 10 years' time, I'll be this age, and I hope I haven't had surgery. And, you know, it has been over 10 years. I've had multiple surgeries, I've had multiple medications. And it's weird to think that you don't really have that much control over it, and that life just kind of goes on regardless of what's happening. And I can only do what I think I can do in a day. You know, if I want to, you know, I've done a full day at work today and done overtime. I couldn't have done that 3 years ago. So I'm really proud of myself today. And I will sleep well if I can get to sleep. But, you know, like tomorrow might not be the same. I might feel absolutely rubbish after someone.
I've learned just planning day by day is loads better for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, do not make extensive future plans.
No.
No, the biggest plan I've got at the minute is pass the level by September, so I don't have to pay the fee again.
Oh, yeah. And then you do level 4.
We
can set up business and do the level 5 whilst we're doing what we're doing.
Wow, this is my plan. Yeah, to set up the bookkeeping after level 3, because you can get the license for it. But I do want to do level 4 while I've currently got my job. So. I'm one of those people that likes to prove not only myself wrong, but probably other people too. Like, I will work full time and study, because this is what I want to do, but I'm doing it to prove a thing to myself, is that my illness does not hold me back.
No, it doesn't.
No. Despite of the good and the bad things that happen, I will carry on. It may take me a little while, that's fine. I may spend a couple of days crying or just not able to do anything, but I will get it done. So.
And what about you, Liam?
Like future plans. Is that what you mean? Like future plans, yeah, or what I'm doing now?
Yeah.
So I've just started my PT course not so long ago. I've decided I'm dropping out of uni just because the stress of it all and exams was just making my health like really bad. Yeah. Like every exam I'd have, I'd end up ill and I was pretty much in hospital. So I've made the decision. This is, once I've finished with this year, I'm just calling it quits on that. And I'm going to do my personal training, but I want to try work with people with health conditions like Crohn's or anything like that. So I feel like I'll understand them a lot, be able to work around it all. That's my plans. I can just do that in my own time. So there's no like rush or deadlines, or I don't have to worry too much about all of that either.
Yeah. And I think people who join that, I think will find it really beneficial that you've also got a health condition, because I think that's a really nice relationship to have, is that you can, person's like me.
Because then if they mention meds or operations or anything like that, I'll like got a good understanding on it all.
You'll be a fountain of knowledge.
Hopefully, yeah.
And you can always come to us for all the advice on the meds.
We're really definitely good at self-assessments.
And tax returns, we can do those.
We do keep right, Bimbo. I think the aim for me, especially over the next 2 years, is obviously to complete my level 3 and 4. I might actually be able to start my level 5 in that time as well. I know I'm crazy, but do you know what, I like proving people wrong, because yeah. I think a lot of people that meet me, I never enlighten them on the fact that actually I might be rather intelligent, and that actually I might actually be quite smart. I just let people think I'm stupid, because the thing is with Crohn's and with like the brain fog and that we get, my brain
I'm bad for brain fog.
Yeah, my brain doesn't always catch up with my mouth, or my brain is overrunning and my mouth is not coming out, or I mix my words up, or I say something silly. I know exactly what I mean, but it just doesn't come out right. And yeah. I just never enlighten people to the fact that actually I'm not stupid. I'm actually doing university courses. I just don't make a point of being a smart ass, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, people didn't think I would do level 3. Because of my health. And I was like, no, I'm still going to do it. And I've come out with mid-80s.
That's amazing. I think, obviously, to sum it up and on a more positive note, yes, we might be ill. Yeah, there might have been a few hurdles in the way, but it doesn't mean that you can't be successful in life. Just because you've had a diagnosis and just because things might look bleak, that doesn't mean that you should go down that bleak path and go down that sort of self-deprecating path. It's just about setting yourself goals, whether it be a half goal or a whole goal, and just take it step by step, day by day. I think that is the best advice that we can give anybody.
I'd say on top of that, for anyone who is ill, not to compare themselves to like a normal person, because they'll probably be shooting off doing their thing at their pace, and then we'll get knocked back with an illness or operation or something, and then we can feel down about all that. But like you said there, just go at your own pace.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's go at your own pace.
Finding your own pace, there's nothing wrong with it being different to other people. You know, if you need to go rest, go rest. That's just what your body needs. Listen to it, because you only get one body.
Mm. So you only get one mind, but you do get plenty of chances. So if at first you don't succeed,
try again.
So, all right, we're going to wrap this up for World IBD Day. I would like to say a massive thank you to Louise and Liam for taking part in this. If you do wish to follow them, or if you do wish to message them, you can find Louise at Young Crohn's, and you can find Liam over at, it's IBD Liam, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously you can find me over at Crohn's Fighting. So a massive thank you to everybody for listening. I will be back with another podcast soon. If you are interested in sampling anything from Pelican Healthcare, if you head over to www.pelicanhealthcare.co.uk, and I will be back with another podcast soon. So if you'd like to say bye.
See ya.